Today is Monday, March 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up...
The shooting happened just after rush hour, around 10:45 local time in Utrecht, which is in central Netherlands. It's a very busy, popular city in the Netherlands. It's a university town.
That's reporter Catherine Field. We'll have the latest on the shooting in the Netherlands. Also ahead, the community of Christ Church New Zealand comes together in the wake of two mosque attacks that killed 50 people. It's all on today's International Edition. New Zealand's Prime Minister said today that her cabinet has made decisions about the reform of gun laws following Friday's massacre at two mosques in Christchurch. Prime Minister Ardern said all of the bodies of the 50 people killed at the mosques will be returned to their families by Wednesday so they can be buried according to Muslim tradition. Residents of Christchurch have been bringing flowers and other mementos to a makeshift memorial. My colleague Steve Miller is in Christchurch. He spoke with me about the large community response and outreach of support for the victims.
Yeah, it's actually quite amazing. We take a look at where the two shootings took place, the Al Noor Mosque and the Linwood Mosque. There have been groups gathering on a daily basis to really show support for the Muslim community here in Christchurch. And this afternoon, it was actually really an amazing sight to be seen. We had thousands and thousands of what appeared to be school children, you know, middle high school type age, coming together in this park that's right by the Al Noor Mosque. And they came together to show their support, to sing. It was really an uplifting experience for those who have been through the grieving process since the tragedy on Friday. When I arrived on Sunday, there was a fairly large group assembled in the park by the Al Noor Mosque. And there were people just wrought with grief, you know, hugging each other, crying. And to see so many people come out to show love and support was really quite a powerful message.
I understand also that you spoke with an Afghan refugee who was there. What is her perspective on this?
Well, that was a very interesting story. So this young woman is attending college here in Christchurch. She's been living in the country for 3 years. And one of the reasons why she left Afghanistan is because, in her words, killings at mosques were a common occurrence. So she came to New Zealand and she felt welcome. She felt safe. But when she heard the news on Friday, she was in disbelief. And even when I was speaking to her this morning, she was still in shock, still couldn't believe that something this horrific took place in a country that she feels incredibly welcome in. And for the past 3 days, you know, she was really worried that something like this could happen again, especially since authorities were cautioning Islamic leaders here in New Zealand to close the mosques just out of fear that something bad could happen again. But when you see the words of the Prime Minister, when you see the outpouring of support from the community, she really felt comforted by what the community is doing to help these refugees and these immigrants in the country.
What is the government saying they're going to do regarding gun control?
Well, the Prime Minister has repeatedly said that the gun control laws need to be revisited and need to be changed. Earlier today, I spoke with Dr. Mohammed Anwar, and he's the chair at the New Zealand Islamic Information Center based out of Auckland, New Zealand. He was down here to speak with some of the Islamic leaders down here. And that was a conversation he had with several leaders here in the community who voiced their concerns and objections to some of the gun laws in the country. And he played somewhat of a devil's advocate, saying, yes, that's an important discussion to have, but also you have to take a look at this is a democracy and laws have a process of being changed. And he's very certain that something will happen, but just unclear what will take place because of the democratic process of the country. In addition to the gun laws, the government has also really streamlined the process of families coming in from overseas who wish to attend the funerals that are starting to be planned and take place in terms of fast-tracking visas to make sure family members can be here to, you know, grieve with those who are local, as well as the government has said they will pay for all the burial costs.
Tell me about this Give a Little campaign.
If we look to the internet, there are several organizations and web pages out there where organizations or individuals can essentially start a fundraising campaign. And in New Zealand, one of those organizations is called Give a Little. And since the attack on Friday, the official Give a Little page has amassed more than $5 million New Zealand dollars, which is about $3.5 million U.S. dollars, from over 70,000 different donors. And it's really amazing to see how quickly the community has not only come out in person to support the Islamic community here in Christchurch, but to see the country and people from around the world donate money to help offset any kind of costs, to make sure people have food, to look at what can be done with that money to heal the community.
That was VOA's Steve Miller in Christchurch, New Zealand. Well, at least three people were killed and several others injured in a shooting incident on a tram in the Dutch city of Utrecht today. A manhunt is underway for a Turkish-born man whom authorities have identified as 37-year-old Gökmen Tanış in connection with the incident in a residential neighborhood. Police released a photo of the man they say was associated with the incident. The photo shows a bearded man sitting on the tram wearing a dark blue hooded top. Authorities immediately raised the terror alert to the maximum level of 5 in Utrecht, and Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said a terror attack could not be excluded. However, Turkish media and other news reports indicate the attack stemmed from a family dispute, and the gunman may have specifically targeted at least one of his victims. Security has been increased at Dutch airports as well as mosques and schools, and have been closed in residents were advised to stay home. Reporter Catherine Field spoke with me about the shooting.
The shooting happened just after rush hour, around 10:45 local time in Utrecht, which is in central Netherlands. It's a very busy, popular city in the Netherlands. It's a university town. It's not very well known because it tends to be overlooked because of Amsterdam, but it's a lively university town. And it was whilst this tram was making its way away from the city center towards the residential area that these shots were fired. We don't know any more about how many shots were fired or indeed who was actually the alleged shooter in this particular incident, but immediately the area went into lockdown. Police and counterterrorism officers moved in. The terror threat for the area was raised to its maximum level 5, which is the first time it's ever been raised to that level in the city of Utrecht. Immediately, schools and mosques were put in lockdown, and security was increased across the country on transport hubs and at the airports, and also the border. 90 kilometers away is the German border. German police were also securing the border on their side as well. So it's really come as quite a shock in the Netherlands, which is a country with not just a very low violent crime rate, but very low gun ownership. So there's really big questions about why this town was targeted, why not a bigger city, why not a large transport hub. And certainly, again, the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, is saying that the country would not yield to intolerance, would not yield to violence, but still saying, though, that this was an attack, but not yet saying whether it was a terrorist motive or if it was a criminal motive.
I understand that several people have been reported killed from this shooting.
Indeed. There's various bits of information that are emerging on the shooting. We do know that at least 9 people are in hospital, 3 of those in very serious condition. It's at this stage very difficult to get information. It's been quite extraordinary how little information has come out on this shooting. Usually there's a lot of information comes out on social media very quickly. On this one, no, the police moved in very quickly. They very quickly asked people not to spread information on social media through social networks. And so we've seen, really, if you like, a real clampdown on any information coming out. All that we know has come from either the Prime Minister himself or the head of the country's counter-terrorism organization, who said that they are still looking for suspect or suspects, plural, in regard to this attack.
Also, I know that there are some reports that say that Dutch police are searching for a Turkish-born man. Do you have anything else to add regarding that?
Yes, the police issued a photograph, which was taken on one of the trams in the Utrecht area, of a 37-year-old Turkish-born man, Gökmen Tanis. The photo was taken from a CCTV and has been distributed. Authorities have said that people should be on the lookout but not to approach this man. But again, they're not saying whether he is the alleged gunman, but just saying that he is one of the suspects that they are looking for.
That was reporter Catherine Field. She spoke with me from Paris. Among the top stories in the world, the EU appears set to agree to a delay on Britain's exit from the bloc. Emergency officials in Indonesia say the death toll following the flash floods and mudslides in Setani and Papua, Indonesia's innermost province, has risen to nearly 80, with 43 people still missing, and a water shortage affecting some 6 million people in the normally rainy Philippines reveals management issues and threatens the economy if dry conditions persist. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. More than 150 people were killed and hundreds more were missing yesterday after Cyclone Idai swept through southeastern Africa, with the Mozambican city of Beira hardest hit. A team of International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society's aid workers reached the devastated city yesterday to assess the situation, the organization said in a statement on Monday. The cyclone made landfall Thursday near the coastal city of Beira, Mozambique, with winds of nearly 200 kilometers per hour. The storm then moved west into Malawi and Zimbabwe. Reporter Eddie Gondo has more.
Zimbabwe's southeastern region has in the past 2 days experienced one of the country's worst humanitarian disasters in decades, with hundreds of people displaced, homes swept away, and massive property damage lying in its wake. Cyclone Idai's death toll stands at 31 people dead and counting. Scores of people are reported missing and unaccounted for. President Emmerson Mnangagwa had left the country on a state visit to Abu Dhabi on Friday, just before the cyclone. He announced from overseas that a rescue effort was in place, with the army set to move into the affected area. But the officials on the ground say this is yet to happen. Roads and bridges in most parts of Chimanimani and Chipinge, the hardest hit areas, were swept away by flooding. That leaves the region, which lies in a valley and borders Mozambique, inaccessible to the rest of the world. The Chimanimani Hotel is busy receiving distressed residents fleeing the flood. Mandla Mataore is a manager at the hotel.
It's been very chaotic. The cyclone came through and, it's devastated us. So last night there were very heavy winds and rain. And we woke up this morning and, there's been a lot of casualties. Well, the numbers are growing. We're on about 390 so far. They're from the Ngangu village mainly, but from all over. Well, we need everything. I mean, we need medical supplies. We need blankets, clothing. People's houses have been taken away. So you can imagine they've just got the clothes on their back and whatever they could salvage. We're marooned, unfortunately, because where we are, the only other access point would be through Chimoyo in Mozambique, which obviously is another place where this cyclone came from, that side anyway.
All residents of the affected area were warned about the impending disaster. The destruction was far greater than expected. For now, appeals are being made for tents, food, and medicines to assist the injured. And the country needs all the help it can get. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo.
Thank you, Eddie. Where shares in aviation company Boeing fell more than 2% in early trading today, a day after officials in Ethiopia said that last week's Ethiopian Airlines crash may have similarities with an Indonesian crash last year. The planes in both accidents were Boeing 737 MAX 8 jets. In both, the planes went down shortly after takeoff and all on board perished. Boeing grounded all 737 MAX jets last week. One particular area of scrutiny is a new automated system meant to prevent planes from stalling. It is thought to have contributed to last year's Lion Air crash in Indonesia. While the International Organization for Migration reports Latin America has displaced previous record holder, the Mediterranean Sea, as the deadliest route for migrants in the world. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Thousands of refugees and migrants have died while making the perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea into Europe. The region's grim yearly record as the deadliest route for migrants for now has been broken by Latin America. International Organization for Migration spokesman Joel Millman says since February 1st, 79 deaths have been reported along this route. He says this is nearly three times higher than the numbers reported in the Mediterranean. He agrees the rise in deaths is a consequence of increased migration from Latin American countries to the United States. He tells VOA the journey has become more dangerous because of greater reliance by refugees and migrants on smugglers to transport them to the U.S. border.
Circular migration, in which there were repeat customers every year in Latin America going to jobs, has largely ended. And that means that the relationship that migrants have with the people who transport them tends to be much harsher, and they're dealing with a more criminal class of smuggler than existed a generation ago. Clearly, that shows up in the numbers of people killed.
Millman says smugglers often take risks and cut corners to increase profits. He says many drive unsafe vehicles, and this often results in deadly accidents. Just 10 days ago, he notes a truck accident in Mexico's southern state of Chiapas killed 24 Guatemalan men and women. He says this year has been a particularly deadly one for Guatemalans. He says this crash was one of the worst reported by IOM in the past 5 years. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Border Crossings.
Join host Larry London.
Larry London.
On Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour.
Whoa.
Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews.
Ooh.
Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA. Or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world.
Ah.
Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
Well, a group of Cuban doctors have voiced concerns about how they are practicing medicine in Venezuela. A story published in the New York Times newspaper reports on interviews with 16 doctors from Cuba's medical mission to Venezuela. The doctors told the Times that they were forced to withhold drugs and treatment from their Venezuelan patients until they agreed to vote for and support the Socialist Party of Nicolas Maduro. Some mission members did not want to be identified because they said their families in Cuba could face problems. But Dr. Yancier Arias said he knew what he was being asked to do was wrong. The report says the mission members told about using their services to secure votes for the governing Socialist Party, often through coercion. Methods varied from reminding patients to vote for the government to denying treatment to opposition supporters. Well, the UN Refugee Agency and partners have begun moving thousands of Venezuelan asylum seekers and migrants in Brazil to new homes to reduce pressure on communities hosting them. Lisa Schlein again reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
More than 200,000 Venezuelans fleeing economic hardship, political oppression, and human rights abuse have arrived in Brazil since 2017. Most of them are living in the northern part of the country, putting a strain on the local residents hosting them. The UN Refugee Agency and partners have begun relocating more than 5,000 Venezuelans from Brazil's northern state of Roraima to 17 other states in the country. UN refugee spokesman Baba Balosh tells VOA this voluntary relocation scheme is designed to ease the pressure on host communities.
What I understand from talking to my colleagues in Brazil is that many of them are sleeping rough on the streets. Not everyone is able to find a job, not able to sustain themselves once they arrive in Brazil. So this support is very important for them. And this targets different vulnerable groups as well, from families, individuals.
Balosh says the whole idea behind the project is to move the Venezuelan refugees and migrants to different parts of Brazil where there are better opportunities to find homes and jobs. A first group of 225 Venezuelans boarded a Brazilian Air Force aircraft on Wednesday. They took off from Boa Vista, the capital of the state of Roraima, for 13 different cities in Brazil. The UNHCR says more flights are scheduled over the coming weeks. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Overwhelmed by tourists, Venice will soon start to charge an entrance fee. Venice Mayor Luigi Brugnaro says the money raised will help pay for the upkeep of the historic Lagoon City. Venice routinely has more tourists than permanently declared residents. Rising housing costs and the use of properties for tourist accommodation have driven the population down by two-thirds since the middle of the 20th century. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
For years, Venice has been struggling with numerous woes, including high tides that regularly flood St. Mark's Square and growing numbers of tourists. To deal with the endless flows of tourists, no solutions at this moment are final. But starting this year, all tourists will be paying a fee that will go towards the upkeep, cleaning, and services that are needed for this extraordinary city to survive. City administrators say the maintenance costs of Venice are extremely high compared to other cities. Visitors who stay in hotels for the night are already paying a tax, which is added to their room rate. But later this year, day trippers or tourists who visit Venice for just a few hours will also be subject to a fee. Mayor Brugnaro this week outlined the plan to the foreign press gathered in Rome. He said they want to defend the city for current and future residents and visitors, because Venice is a marvel of the world, and only in this way will they be able to safeguard it. Brugnaro said an experimental entrance fee of about $3 will be charged to those who visit Venice this year, but said no date had yet been set as to when this charge would start. The fee, the mayor said, would be collected by transport companies bringing the visitors to the city on planes, trains, buses and cruise boats. Cameras, he said, would also be installed in certain parts of Venice for those arriving for the day in private cars. He made clear there would be stiff fines for those who do not comply with the new charge. Some, like students and workers, would be exempt from paying the fee, as would those who were born and reside in Venice and children under the age of 6. From January 1, 2020, the entrance fee will be set to about $7, but will be variable and range from $3 to $11, depending how busy the city is. Some in Venice say they do not believe the entrance fee plan will work. Lawyer Roberta Pierabon said it will be impossible to implement. She said visitors arrive from all sides. It's impossible to block Venice because Venice is an island and you reach it on water. She does not believe the flow of arrivals can be controlled and added that she disapproved of the plan. Other Venetians favor the idea, saying that it will help control the tourism so that it is not so aggressive. Michele Tessari often works with tourists on lagoon transport. He said Venetians would like a more elite kind of tourism, not so much eat-and-run tourism, and the entrance fee will help with this. He says locals want to avoid seeing tourists eating their sandwiches sitting on the bridges of Venice like tramps. Venetians love their city and know it will never stop attracting visitors. Venice is so special, they say, that it belongs to the whole of humanity, and everyone should have the opportunity to visit this incredible city at least once in their lifetime. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Well, you've been listening to VOA's International Edition. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.